Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
The greatest voices in rap of all time. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 146, a talk with Fonte Coleman. Fonte is best known for his work with the pioneering rap group Little Brother, who came straight out of North Carolina in the early 2000s and garnered praise from fans and artists alike by giving a new spin to classic hip-hop. Fonte was a standout. With his witty, dense rhymes, packed with sometimes obscure allusions, and his powerful singing. With supporters like Questlove and Pete Rock, Little Brother gained enough attention to garner a deal with Atlantic Records for their 2005 album, The Minstrel Show. While the deal itself was short-lived, the group continued to release material up until they disbanded in 2007. While Little Brother was going on, Fonte met, at least through the internet, the Dutch producer Nicolay, and the two began collaborating as The Foreign Exchange. That group is still going strong, with their latest album, Tales from the Land of Milk and Honey, coming out just last year. As if all that wasn't enough, Coleman has released his own solo album, 2011's Charity Starts at Home, with a follow-up due later this year. Most recently, he played a key role in the VH1 movie, soon to be a series, The Breaks, a story about the hip-hop industry in 1990. He wrote the raps for pretty much all of the characters, and even made a small appearance himself as an Afrocentric rapper named Imam Ali. It was with that we began our conversation. We connected with Fonte via Skype. If you enjoy The Cypher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should listen to our interview with Fonte's former Little Brother groupmate, rapper Big Poo, on episode 101. Speaking of our archive, if you want us to add to it by making new episodes, visit patreon.com/thecyphershow and become a patron. You can find more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play, at thecyphershow.com. While you're there, make sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter to keep track of everything that's going on with us. And now, here's the only person ever to imitate all the members of the Wu-Tang Clan and the Hot Boys, Fonte Coleman. I'd like to thank Imam Ali for coming on the show and speaking to me, even though I'm a white devil.
Yeah, Imam Ali, I don't think he would turn down any press opportunity, even if it was the white devil. I don't think Imam Ali discriminates in that way.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I mean, I guess you start off talking about The Breaks. So much of what you did there was just super, super funny. Like, I heard the demo for the Joe Rock character, and it's fucking hysterical. And I guess, like, I was kind of thinking about this, like, was it tough for you to write bad rhymes? Because he's supposed to be like a mediocre rapper.
I'm on the mic, DB on the cutting. Y'all talking loud, but you ain't saying nothing. When I'm on the mic, I rock so well. J-O-E, tell me what that spell. Show rock, baby, nonstop, baby. Show rock, baby, nonstop, baby.
Yeah, I mean, it actually is kind of hard. I mean, the thing about it is that with Joe Rock in particular, you know, you have to write something. The notes that, you know, they gave me was that, you know, you have to write something that is bad, clearly not not so bad that the audience would question why DV would even work with the guy. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So it had to be something where it was clear that Joe Rock was not, you know, that good. He was kind of okay. But there had to be a clear difference between him and who is the guy, you know, who is that dude. So, right. So writing the Joe Rock thing, that was a lot of fun. That was funny. But yeah, it is difficult to kind of be like that mediocre kind of middle of the road thing. And the same thing it was for Primo as well. Me and him talking, and you know, he was the same thing. Him in terms of making the beat, he was just like, man, they told me like that, make a beat that's like, you know, maybe 50% of your powers, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it was a tricky space to operate in, but it's ultimately it was good practice though, you know.
It
was dope.
And you learned how to spell Joe.
Joe, tell me what's that spell? I mean, come on, it can spell so many different things. Like apparently,
right? And how on earth did you come up with all those names on the shoutouts? The shoutouts at the end are obviously like twice as long as his verse. That's part of the joke.
To my man, Nice Ice, Boo, McShay. To my man, Wop Wop. This one goes out to Shonda, Rhonda, Sharice.
Oh man, oh, definitely. The shout outs are completely the doings and the makings of Dan Charnas. Dan opened up his laptop when we were in the studio tracking it with Dean Acree. He's the actor who played Joe Rock. Shout out to him. Shout out to my man Dean. Really good brother. And he's kind of just prepping or whatever. And so Dan just pulls out his laptop. And he's like, you know, I'm going to write some shout outs. And I'm like, all right, cool. And he had this elaborate list of names. And I mean, by the end of the shit, we were all fucking dying.
He's getting that money at the nail salons. To Mr. Perez, chilling in apartment 3 on 231 Norman Ave in Brooklyn, buzzer number 16. To my girl Sharice, who used to babysit me when I was 8. You fine, I'm legal now. And to all the stray animals out there in these hard streets, I know that.
They were so random and so varied, but yet, you know, so authentic. And it was very much, you know, one of those times where we played the record for Primo and King of Chill at Primo Studio. And King of Chill was like, yo, that's exactly how it was. He was like, yo, we have to switch reels because, you know, cats be giving shout outs for 4 minutes. So, you know what I mean? So that was one of those times where, you know, to be validated and to have, you know, brothers from that era to actually, you know, confirm that you got it right. That was just one of my favorite moments, one of my favorite parts of the whole process, just to be able to have, you know, the legends from that era that actually made those records hear it and say, yeah, y'all got this one right. That was pretty much all the validation we needed.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things about the breaks was you had to teach Antoine Harris how to rap. Like, he was an actor. I mean, he may have been a rap fan, I don't know, but he wasn't a rapper. So like, what did you learn having to kind of go back to square one and show someone how to rap?
Oh man. Well, first and foremost, I mean, big ups to Antoine Harris just because he made my job a lot easier, you know what I'm saying? He is just an incredible talent, you know what I'm saying, and just a very smart and intuitive actor. And, you know, the best way I can describe him is just that it's like, you know, the John Wooden quote, you know, where he says, you know, the mark of a good player is that he'll do everything I tell him to do, but I don't got to tell him to do everything. And so Antoine was just one of those dudes, man, you know. He definitely is a hip hop fan, grew up listening to hip hop, you know, was familiar. But I guess working with him and having to kind of teach him to go through it, it really had to take me back to a lot of basics and just getting a lot of mechanics together. For instance, like when we're in the studio and we're actually tracking, you know, with Primo, just having to tell him, okay, yo, this was dope, but I need you to lean in on this word a little more. Give me this certain inflection on Dracula. You got to make, I think it was like a part where he had to make Dracula, modern day Dracula's, vampires that be acting up.
Little tiny apartments that feel like they could double as coffins. Modern day Dracula's, vampires that be acting up. Spending life in the maximum security prison. Because when it come time to squeeze, you better have heart or the lack thereof.
I was like, but in order to, for that multi-syllable, in order for that line to work, you got to make the A in Dracula like a you know what I'm saying? So really, give me the modern day Dracula, you know what I'm saying?
Modern day Draculas, vampires that be acting up, spending life in a maximum security prison.
So just little things like that, you know what I mean, that to me as an MC, having been doing it for so long, or just kind of second nature, you really just, I guess the best way I can describe it, man, it's like if you a person that's just been building cars all your life, or you've been, you know, working on an assembly line or on cars, and like building cars is just something that you can do secondhand now. It's almost like now, like having to deconstruct the car and really seeing all the work that goes into it. And it's like, God damn, it's a lot of work to go into this shit. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It was like,
definitely.
Shit.
Definitely.
So that was, I guess, the best analogy I can give. You know, it was really just taking the thing that you've been doing all the time and having to break it down and explain it to someone who is not familiar with it. And it makes you have to be really sharp and really on point in the information that you're given. And you have to explain it in a way that they understand it. So, it was very much, I mean, it was, you know, I guess the phrase they say, you know, learning through teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Just in teaching a process and having to teach someone a process, in turn, you actually learn even more about it.
Yeah. And so a little while ago, we had your former groupmate, Big Poo, on, and, you know, we asked mm-hmm. him this, and, you know, we're going to have to ask you, you know, I'm sure you've heard it a lot, so I apologize in advance, but don't you ever want to punch journalists in the face when they ask about Little Brother reunions?
Nah, man, nah. Nah, man. You know, it's, you know, that there was a point in my life, you know, where I'd be like, fuck, why they ask me this shit? You know what I'm saying? But, you know, man, I've just come to realize and just accept that, you know, whenever you first come out, whatever you first make your mark as in the game, you know, that is what people are always going to be drawn to. That's always going to be what people are have near and dear to their hearts. So, you know, man, that's just a part of the game. I mean, I'm sure, you know, Tina Turner probably be getting tired of motherfuckers asking her about Ike. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you know.
Right.
So
right.
It's like, are you and Ike going to ever get back together? Fuck nah. What the fuck you mean? Like, so, you know, man, I just tell my hell, if Tina Turner can deal with it, then shit, I can deal with it. You know what I mean? So, yeah, you know, it's just, that's just a part of the game. But I understand people are, that just, the little brother just struck a chord with them. So it's only natural for them to want to ask and be curious about what's going on, what happened, what, you know, when will more music, all that stuff. So
right.
I get it.
Right. And, you know, when you guys started out as a group, you got a lot of praise, but in a way that was backhanded compliments. People, you know, and I remember hearing this. You've talked about it. I definitely remember hearing it. People like, yeah, they're good for guys from the South. Like, what mm-hmm. what was it like to get these stuff that people meant as compliments, but was basically saying like, yeah, it's people in the South are idiots, you know, essentially.
Yeah, man. It was definitely, you know, it was, you know, we were, I guess that was kind of the hat trick, you know, that we were able to pull off, you know what I'm saying? And that was somewhat of the novelty effect that in a lot of ways worked to our advantage, you know, more so than I would say worked to our disadvantage. You know, I think, you know, had we been three guys from Brooklyn, I think it, you know, it would have been expected, you know, but, you know, three guys from the South making, you know, just a more traditional boom bap kind of sound, that was something that at that time, you know, wasn't really heard of. It wasn't, you know, it was just new, you know, coming from us. And people were just like, holy shit, you know, what are these guys doing? Where are they from? You know, and, you know, that's amazing. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, it definitely was a little backhanded, you know, compliment. It was a little bit of that. But my whole thing was just, you know, as long as people are listening to the music, as long as, you know, as long as people are into it, then whatever mental jumping jacks they need to tell themselves in order to get into it, I don't give a shit. Mm-hmm. Just buy the fucking record. You know what I mean? that was really it.
Definitely. And, you know, one important part of the Little Brother sound that you know, not a lot of people know about. And this guy has only now just started to get some press. There was an article about him just a week or two ago. Is Geno Brown. Like, who is he, and how is he important to Little Brother?
That's my man. I actually ran to Gene Brown the other night. Gene is he's a producer. He is more so probably widely known as a record collector. He's a record dealer. And so many records, so many of the samples that we've used on our records, and just so many records that Ninth has used just throughout his career, Gene was the guy who supplied them. And so Gene is just a guy who, you know, he would know your sound. Like, if he knows your producer, if he says, okay, I know Ninth likes this kind of chop, or he would kind of chop something kind of like this, you know, he will go and find samples and records, you know, specifically for you, you know. And he's just a cat that, you know, I've known him, we've known each other for years, and just a very musical dude. You know, he just knows music, he knows records, and, you know, nothing gets by him. I mean, he was who sampled before who sampled, you know what I mean? You just play a record for him, and he'd be calling out the samples. It's like, shit, man, how you know all this shit? But, yeah, real good dude, Gene Brown, long time buddy, long time associate, and just all around good dude.
Yeah, and so one of the odd things about Little Brother was kind of, and your career has been kind of the arc of one of your side characters, Percy Miracle, right, who started out doing these parodies in Little Brother. You know, he did the R. Kelly and Mr. Biggs parody.
Can't think of nothing that with 15.
Ooh, Lord, the background singers just messed up.
Well, Percy, I don't give a fuck.
Well, tell me where we gonna go.
We're going to the Mistra show.
You was cheating.
Yes, she was.
Caught you creeping.
We're lying
to the show, and I just
don't know where to go,
baby.
Did a couple other things. Mm. You did a couple other songs as that character. But then you kind of found R&B outpaced your ability to make fun of it, right?
Kinda. I definitely think that it was just with R&B, and I think with, you know, just music in particular, with black music, it became, and I've said this, you know, time and time again, it just became harder to parody something that often parodied itself, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, I would be listening to the radio, or, you know, just, you know, looking at, you know, 106 in Park, or, you know, whatever, and just kind of seeing, you know, the records that was hot at the time. And, you know, if you had records like, you know, if you took Cheating by Percy Miracles.
Girl, you was cheating.
You was cheating.
Yes, you was.
Caught you creeping.
Yes, I did.
To the window, to the wall, skeet, skeet.
You dirty bitch.
And you put that in a lineup with, you know, Laffy Taffy by D4L.
Girl, shake that Laffy Taffy. That Laffy Taffy. Shake that Laffy Taffy. Shake that Laffy Taffy, girl.
And, you know, This Is Why I'm Hot by Mims.
I'm hot cause I'm fly. You ain't cause you not. This is why I'm hot. I'm hot cause I'm fly.
Or like, you know, Chain Hang Low. Like, all these kind of ringtone records that was hot at the time, if you would have put Cheating in a lineup with all those records, and then you asked me to tell you, okay, pick out the parody song, you know, 9 times out of 10, I mean, you couldn't do it. You know, actually, in the context of all those kind of records, Cheating actually sounded reasonable. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, in the context of R. Kelly, it sounded reasonable. You pointed out
my God.
Trapped in the Closet came out after Cheating, and kind of made Cheating by extension sound normal.
Oh, man, exactly. I mean, I remember even blogging about that. Like, I heard the R. Kelly record. I was like, when he did Trapped in the Closet, I was like, oh, my God. Like, I can't, like, this is, yo, he's written an opera. Like, it's, I'm like, dude, I can't. Nah, I can't top this.
In 2006, Fonte wrote an article called Death of a Star, How a Piece of Fried Chicken Killed Percy Miracles. The essay discusses how hard it is to parody current day black music, as he contends black music has become a parody of itself. We'll link to the article in the show notes.
So yeah, seeing that, man, that was just very much for me. As much as I enjoy doing those kind of records, and as much as I enjoy just, you know, the comical element of the comic element of music, of R&B, of hip hop, and all that, I saw that the Percy Miracles thing could very quickly, you know, just as R&B was, you know, outpacing Percy Miracles. You know, I started to see that Percy Miracles could very quickly outpace me.
Yeah.
If I, you know what I'm saying? If I ain't put a muzzle on that shit.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, so yeah, so I just decided to just stop doing it because it could have very easily became a, you know, Flip Wilson, Geraldine kind of situation.
Night on, I drink a rum, stack banana till the morning come.
Woo. Say, big boy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, bananas ain't the only thing around here that look well stacked to me. Oh, my goodness. If it wasn't for Killer, you could be the top banana in my bunch.
Where that's all people want to hear from.
That's all people know, exactly. Yeah. That's all people want to hear. So I slowed it down. But, I mean, you know, I'm not against... You know, I mean, me and actually one of my buddies, we were talking about maybe doing it, you know, as an animated series, like bringing it back in some kind of way, because it's a character that I love, but there has to be some kind of distance between me and the character, and animation, an animated series, or just little clips or whatever, that would do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so that's kind of where it's at now.
Yeah. And I wanted to take it back to some of your big early influences. It's obvious, you know, from listening to you, from the record you made with Zoe, that kind of the early to mid 80s, all the stuff from that era, from like Steve mm-hmm. Arrington, Spyro Gyra, all the way to like whatever hit songs were on the radio at the time, are kind of big influences on you. What is it about that era that kind of fascinates you and has you kind of keep coming back to it for inspiration?
I think for me, just the 80s, personally, they play such a big part for me, just because, you know, that was the first time that I really, you know, noticed music. You know, that was my first taste of music, period, you know. And I think people are going to always, you know, Chris Rock, he had a quote one time. He was like, you know, people are always going to have an affinity for the music that they got laid to.
Man, I've been loving rap music forever. And as I get older, I realize I'm going to love rap music when I'm 80, 90. Pretty much whatever music was playing when you started getting laid, you're going to love that music for the rest of your life. So I'm always going to have a soft spot for Houdini. You know what I mean?
Like the first, you know, the first song that you, you know, got laid to, you're always going to have a love for music from that era. Now, I didn't get laid in the 80s is because I was like, you know, 4 and 5, you know, but... Well, you know, that didn't happen, but the 80s, that was my first real taste of music. And so that was the first, you know, that soul early, late 70s, early 80s, just soul and R&B, funk, you know, Parliament, Funkadelic, Cameo, and then even on the pop side with, you know, stuff like Level 42, got Heart. My uncle, he was a really big Heart fan, and like, he would play their records. So all of that stuff, man, just, you know, it leaves an early impression on you. You know, it leaves a big impression on you really early when you start taking in those sounds. And you know, and it was funny. Like I was in a session the other night with Tamisha Wayden, who was one of the singers in tours with us in Foreign Exchange. Me and her were working on a track, and every so often, like, we'll be working on something and I'll just stop and I'll be like, yo, you remember this? Like, we'll just go pull up Spotify and just be like, yo, you remember this song? And we'll just kind of go on like a 15-minute tangent, you know, where we're just bullshitting and not working. So, you know, just to kind of clear the air, keep shit fresh, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
And so I was just pulling up records and she was just like, she's like, Fonte, were you listening to this kind of stuff, you know, at when you were this age? She's like, because it makes a lot of sense now, like why your ear is the way it is. And having her say that, I never thought of it in that way. To me, it was just music, you know, but she's like a piano player, you know, she's, you know, a player and, you know, a singer. And, you know, she was able to break down, like, you know, take me to the piano and break down like chords and say, okay, well, right here, you're singing this and this is what they're doing right here. And that moves from F major to G, whatever the hell, you know what I mean? Like she, you know, she could break it all down. And, That, I think, for me, it kind of just made me look and be like, well, man, I guess I was listening to kind of advanced stuff, you know, at the time. But to me, it was just music. I didn't even really think, you know, that it was that crazy. It was just music, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, even like if you look at a record and this was a... So it was an interview that I had read like some years back, and I want to say it was with Kenny Loggins, but you know he was breaking down, you know, What a Fool Believes, and What a Fool Believes is like a song that, you know, it comes on in a bar, like, you know, everybody will sing it, you know what I'm saying, like everybody, it's a karaoke song, everything, but it's a really classy kind of song, you know what I'm saying? Musically, it's really I'm trying to think of the right word. It's not just no run of the mill shit, basically. You know what I'm saying? Some of those chords that he's playing and just that music, I mean, it's trying to play it on piano. That shit is kind of a beast. You know what I'm saying? But that was something that in the 80s, I mean, that was a pop song. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, something that kind of, that distinguished, something that is sophisticated, is that, that's what I'm looking for. Something that's that sophisticated, I mean, that was considered a pop song. And that was the kind of stuff that we were listening to, you know, at that age. You know, I was, you know, a kid, like, listening to that kind of stuff. And, that just kind of shaked my ear and really gave me a sense of adventure.
Yeah. And, you know, on the hip hop side, I know that Long Live the Kane was huge for you. You've rapped about that. You've talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
She rapping ace, spitting murderers. Bought Long Live the Kane, sat down and learned every word of it. Sneaking my Walkman in the homeroom, playing it. Listen for punchlines, delivery, and cadences. But nowadays, it's like...
I was looking at this yesterday for a different reason. There was a lot of shit that came out in 88, which is the year Long Live the Kane came out, basically.
Oh, my God.
I mean, you know, NWA, Eazy-E, Ultra Mag, yeah. By All Means mm-hmm. Necessary.
By All Means Necessary, Nation of Millions.
Yeah. Why did Long Live the Kane stick out for you in particular?
I think Long Live the Kane stuck out to me just because, to me, he was every man. You know what I'm saying? Like... Chuck D and Public Enemy, they were political. And, you know, Flavor Flav was the foil, you know what I'm saying? He was kind of the comic relief in some ways, but that shit wasn't comical. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't, you know what I mean? Yeah. You know what I mean? You didn't put on Nation of Millions just to kind of kick back and just, you know, take your mind off the troubles of the day. Like, that just wasn't happening. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's not my relaxation album. You're not going to do that to Nation of Millions. So, yeah, you know, I thought that, you know, Public Enemy, they had the militant political side locked down. Ultramagnetic, they just had that, you know, and honestly, it took me a while to get into Ultramags. I was a little late arriving on that train. I didn't catch them until around like 94 with the Funk Your Head Up record with the Papa Large. And then I went back and checked Critical Beatdown, you know. But Ultra Mags, they just, you know, Kool Keith was just that wild, just that off the wall, you know, persona, you know, who would just say anything and was just so, he was a character, you know what I'm saying? Both, you know, in and out of the studio, as I understand. But, you know, he really was a character. And so they had that kind of, you know, weird, quirky kind of that thing going on. Basically, Cool Keith was, he was kind of MF Doom before MF Doom, you know, in my opinion. You know what I'm saying? He set the stage for, you know, a guy like Doom, you know, to be able to kind of have a following, you know, in my opinion. So, you know, you had a lot of, you know, BDP, KRS, he was, man, he was like, to me, he just had like one, and has, I should say, just one of the greatest voices in rap of all time, you know what I'm saying? He just was so commanding on the mic, and he just, you know, I remember hearing like My Philosophy and like seeing the video for My Philosophy, and, you know, to have the beat start and then just stop, and I'm just gonna say the first verse with no beat. Let's begin. What, where, why, or when?
While being played, such as to a game. See, I'm not insane. In fact, I'm kind of rational. When I be asking you who is more dramatic, this one or that one, the white one or the black one, pick the punk and I'll jump up to attack one. KRS-One is just the guy to lead a crew. Right up to your face and diss you.
I was like, what the fuck? Is this motherfucker, he preaching? What the fuck? You know what I'm saying? Like, that was some crazy shit. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you had all those guys that kind of took their own, they kind of had their own niche, you know, their own little kind of corner of it, of hip hop. And so with Long Live the King, man, that was like, I heard myself in a lot of ways. Like, Kang was the guy who, you know, he could be the ladies man. He could battle rap. You know, he was witty. You know, he could give you punchlines. You know, he was kind of the total package. And hearing Long Live the King, that was when I first saw MC and was like, yo, that's who I want to be. I want to be that guy. You know what I'm saying? I'm not, you know, militant like Public Enemy. I'm not kind of weird and off the wall like a Cool Keith. You know, I'm not preaching like KRS. You know what I'm saying? But, you know, if I can, you know, say some fly shit, get the girl, and embarrass you on the mic on some battle shit, you know, if I can do those things as Kane, yeah, I can do that.
Yeah.
And so that's why it really just, it resonated with me.
And then years later, of course, you'd work with him on Welcome to Durham.
Big Daddy Kane in the house. Feel me out. Staring in the face of death and I'm looking in the mouth like, goddamn, I found Brooklyn in the south. Coming up inside the hood, it's due to curse you. But coming up inside the hood, it's universal. The shells from the back.
Did you guys do that in the same space? Or because I know he has lived in North Carolina for a while.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Kane was, I believe he's still here, if I'm not mistaken. I haven't, actually haven't run into him in a while. But yeah, man, Kane is actually the cat who DJs for him, my man DJ Skaz, who was out of Durham. And Skaz is crazy. I actually ran into him the other night at Rich Medina. Rich Medina was here spinning in Durham, and I just kind of got out of the house for a while to go check him. And I ran into Skaz there. And so Skaz is Kane's tour DJ. And Skaz was actually the first DJ to spin for me when I came to Durham in 97. And at North Carolina Central, he, you know, was the first DJ to spin for me at during the talent show. And, you know, just kind of just going back and forth playing instrumentals, you know. and so yeah, man, so me and him, you know, we really it's a lot of history there. But yeah, Kane, so when we actually did that record, yeah, we were all in the same studio. Kane was there, of course, my man Mike Nice was there, big ups to him, part of the Butter team. It was a DJ crew, legendary DJ crew out of Durham. And, you know, we were all in the same space. And so I remember writing the rhyme before I got there and then having to spit it, and I just kept messing up. So I was like, fuck, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, I just, because I wanted to get it right so bad. Like, I just wanted to get it right because, you know, I'm sitting, you know, 10 feet away from my idol, you know what I mean? And you know, I really wanted to get it right just so bad. And finally, I just kind of calmed down, like, okay, let me get this shit. And so I got it down. And, you know, I remember leaving the studio, and before I left, I was like, yo, Kane, man. I said, Ben, you're the reason why I do this, man. Like, you're the reason why I rap. And he was just like, oh, word up. Appreciate it. Thank you. You know, it was just real, real cool, you know. And, yeah, man, that's just one of those moments that, you know, if you would have told me, you know, listen to Long Live the Cane as a 9-year-old, that I would be in the studio with this guy some, you know, 12, 13, 14 years later, I mean, yeah, I wouldn't have believed you. I'd have laughed you out the studio.
Yeah. But, yeah. And one of the things about that Kane did, particularly, you know, on that first album, and he told me he got this from Kaz, was rhyme long strings of the same sound. Mm-hmm.
Here's Big Daddy Kane from Cypher episode 32.
I learned that from Grandmaster Kaz, from the Cold Crush brothers. You know, that brother, he was doing that back in 1981. You know, he had some little rhyme he did, like, I just steal the field, make sure it's real. And if you go and get your brother, I won't kneel, just thrash and bash and get cold cash, smoke hash in a flash, but I don't dash. You know, like, so that's where I really, you know, learned that from Grandmaster Kaz and the Cold Crush brothers.
Wow. Yeah, because Ultramagnetic was doing that same kind of style at around the same time as well.
Yeah. Well, they probably learned it from Kaz, too. You know, I mean, Kaz.
Right. Mm-hmm. Keep a particular rhyme going for a long time. You do that a fair amount as well. There's a couple, you know, there's definitely a few songs where you keep that going, and it becomes almost a joke in itself how long you keep the rhyme scheme going.
I say what I feel till I ain't gotta say no more. I dedicate this to the A&Rs that said LB is in the game, but they ain't playing ball. And all the turncoat niggas who forgot what we was playing for. So you can call this the denouement. It's the removal of a fixture, a complicated picture, and not even Clarissa could explain it all. You're mad with me, tough titty, get a training bra. This is the marathon I have been training for ever since me and Big Pooh was getting rental cars. Ever since Christ is banging out on the ASR, never leave the game, just change the way I play the cards. Hey yo, who them boys?
Yeah, man, Kane was you know, to me that was kind of like I don't know, it was just, I always looked at it as it's kind of like, you know, how you and your homie would like go to the, y'all in the summertime, you at the pool or whatever, and you play the game of, okay, who can hold your breath the longest? Who can stay underwater the longest or whatever? You know what I'm saying? That, to me, was what those kind of rhyme schemes were. It was just like, okay, how far can you go on this word or on this syllable, and how, you know, how creative can you be with it, you know? And so those things for me are just always, you know, exercises I look at them as. You know, you want to just see if I have a word or if I have a string of words, how far can I take it? How many different ways can I find to rhyme that? You know what I'm saying? And they can be pure rhymes, you know what I'm saying? In the sense of, you know, a pure rhyme is like, you know, just a pure rhyme, like rhyme and time, like that's a pure rhyme. But then you can also take it to like a slant rhyme where it's not dead on, but it's a slant rhyme depending on how you lean into it. So a slant rhyme can be something like, you know, I don't know, like, man, like time and line, L-I-N-E, you know. Those words don't rhyme in a pure sense, but you can slant and lean into one or the other to kind of make them fit, you know what I'm saying? Eminem is like the master at that, of like slant rhyme. He is just, he would take words that it's like, oh my God, like how did you bend that to make it sound like this?
Became a millionaire, went downhill from there. Became civil, office swivel chair, sterling silverware, screaming life is still unfair, till I get a real career. Fuck am I gonna do until then? This job is too fulfilling. 2 kajillion pairs of supervillain shoes to fill in the mood to kill till I plowed my coupe de villain to some children at the food pavilion at Build-A-Bear.
And it was funny, I think you even tweeted me. You asked me, like, how did I get denouement? How did I rhyme denouement?
with you know? With training bra.
With training bra, yeah. Yeah, that was one of those things. That was one of those things where it's just like, okay, well, you know, in the context of what I was talking about, and if, you know, depending on where you place the emphasis on the syllable, you know, it can sound like that. So I forgot what the line. This is the, you could call this, what was it? Oh, this is denouement. It's the illusion of a picture, complicated picture. Not even Carissa can explain it all. You mad with me, tough titty, to get a training bar. This is the training. This is the, oh, God. It's This is something I've been training for ever since me and Big Pooh was getting rental cars. Yeah, like that was just the, all of those are slant rhymes. None of those words rhyme in a pure sense. But if you can match the cadence with it and, you know, place the emphasis on the right syllables, then it works and it sounds dope. So kind of giving away Tracy. Like, yeah, it's like, well, no, it's like this became a writing workshop.
Yeah, well, no, it's great. I mean, I feel like you kind of definitely try to surprise people by doing things like that, keeping rhyme schemes going or like having multiple rhymes going kind of in the same line, like doing a internal rhyme, you know? Mm-hmm. Like have rhymes at the end of a line, but then also in the middle.
Fonse's a rhyme, phenom, menon. I hail from the city of the martyrs, Greensboro. Spit thorough for the robbers and the bloggers, and even for the fathers. Listening with the kids like Tay and Sean Don. Damn, they got a problem.
Yeah, Rakim. That was Rakim. That was him. That was Rakim him. Was the old man. Yeah, Rakim was just the internal rhyme guy.
Brothers try, others die to get the formula. But I'ma let you sweat. You still ain't warm. You a step away from frozen, stiff as if you're posing. Digging through my brain as the rhyme gets chosen. So follow.
You know him. He was definitely like the for me. You know, hearing that, he was the guy for that. And you can even hear that in. You know, in Special Ed, you know, if you look at, I mean, I got it made. I'm your idol, the highest title, numero uno. Not a Puerto Rican, but I'm speaking so that you know.
And understand I got the gift of speech and it's a blessing. So listen to the lesson I preach. I talk sense condensed into the form of a poem. Full of knowledge from my toes to the top of my dome. I'm kind of young.
You know what I mean? Like that is a straight up Rakim, you know, if there was ever any question as to who Special Ed's influences were, one of his influences, I mean, you have Rakim right there in that first line. You know, I'm your idol, highest title, numero uno, not a Puerto Rican, but I'm speaking. Like, that's an internal rhyme right there before he starts to rhyme, you know, before the Puerto Rican, I'm speaking so that you know, and the you know ties back with, you know, the other line. So, yeah, man, Rakim was definitely my teacher in terms of that.
You know, I also love that you have a lot of references on your songs that can be pretty obscure. Like you had the, you know, there's Sketches of Spain, the Miles Davis record.
On a way to Brazil, rocking the Sketches of Spain. Passengers laughing like what the heck's they saying.
That's the old Bartles and James commercials.
Fonte is a part of the change into my horrors galore. I thank you for your support like Bartles and James. I go past the...
Kind of random and kind of obscure. When you think of stuff like that and you write it down, who do you... imagine the audience is for things like that?
Man, I honestly have no idea, dude. I have no idea. I mean, my thing is, you know, I remember reading an interview a while ago, and this was with, I want to say, was it with Kenan Ivory Wayans? I think it was with him, but I know it was with the comedian. I want to say it was with Kenan Ivory Wayans, but he was saying something to the effect of, you know, with making jokes and, you know, telling jokes as a comedian. And he was like, you know, you're going to have those jokes that everyone may not connect with. You know what I'm saying? You're going to have those jokes that everyone may not get. But the two or three or four people that do get it are going to be laughing their asses off. You know what I'm saying? And so for me, with the references and stuff, I kind of play it both ways in the sense that, you know, I try to write it from a standpoint of, okay, even if you don't get the reference, it's just going to sound dope. It's just going to sound fly just because the way I'm placing it in the rhyme. So rhythmically and just kind of, you know, the way I may play with my inflection on it, I mean, it's going to sound good. But the people that get that reference are going to be like, holy shit, it's going to work on both levels for them.
Yeah.
And those are the people that will then explain to the other people, like, what? I don't get it. It's like, yo, you don't understand Bartles and James.
If you're tired of having your ice just plain, add some Bartles and James. We hope you appreciate this suggestion. And thank you for your support.
That was the fucking commercial. You know what I mean? Like, just, you know, that's what all the rap nerds can break it down. So, yeah, man, I guess I don't really have anyone in mind when I'm writing it. It's just more so, you know, I just think of just people who are just, I guess, pop culture kind of nerds like me that just watched a bunch of fucking TV and just kind of, you know, just have all this random trivia in their head.
Yeah. What's one of your favorite lines like that, where you kind of snuck something in and figured not a ton of people would get it?
Oh my God. Oh shit, man. It was maybe something that, something from Charity Starts at Home, just, from the song Everything is Falling Down, where it's like, what was that? Late Nights.
Late Nights by the bedside, God praise him. He's the captain that told me to kneel. And when I was,
you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, that yeah.
was, you know what I mean? That was just something where, if you just on a basic level, I mean, you get it. Just, you know, God is the captain that told me, like, to kneel, to drop to my knees. But also, I mean, you get, you know, the captain and to kneel.
Right.
So,
right.
You know what I mean? Which, you know, you kind of got to, I mean, not that that's like the most obscure reference, but I mean, when's the last time you played a captain and to kneel reference? Yeah, I mean,
yeah, and that actually leads me into something else, which is like, even in talking about pretty serious topics, you'll sneak in jokes. Sometimes you'll sneak in dirty jokes. while you're talking about pretty sincere, pretty emotional things, how do you balance like humor and sadness, humor and like a more sincere emotion when you're writing songs?
I think you have to have a balance. You know what I'm saying? One of the things that sticks out to me was reading an interview with Gary Trudeau, who was the guy behind Doonesbury, a political cartoon. And one of the things he said, he was like, you know, if you're going to write about Vietnam on Monday, you better write about basketball on Tuesday. And I was just like, man, like, that's a dope way to say that. You know what I'm saying? And I mean, his basic message was just that, you know, if you're going to write about something heavy, you kind of got to follow it up with something light just to take the foot off the neck of the audience. Because if everything is just heavy, 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 heavy all the time, then those messages lose their impact. You know, if you just are constantly beating your audience over the head with just a heavy message, they just, you know, they just get kind of, it's just like, man, okay, we get it. Vietnam is bad, motherfucker. All right. You know what I mean? So for me, I just would always try, even if I'm talking about something that's really emotional or really, really just kind of, you know, dark, just to try to add those moments of levity. And just so, you know, I just show people that, you know, I'm just not taking myself that seriously. And so it just doesn't go completely fucking emo. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So
I try to do that.
Yeah. You know, as far as live performances go, you know, you in one of your songs later, you know, sort of towards the middle of Little Brother and Flash and Flare, you have a line about performing at Cat's Cradle, which is, you know, a club in the Triangle back in 98.
But y'all fuckers gonna make me relapse for real and take it back to 98 on you niggas when I was straight disabling niggas. I'm Mike's first place, Cat's Cradling niggas. I ain't got time to play with you niggas for now. That's all I gotta say to you niggas. This is history.
What were those performances? Were those like the open mic talent show things? Were you actually doing shows back then?
Yeah, I mean, we were doing, you know, little gigs, man. I mean, we would just, you know, we would do open mics. We would do, you know, I mean, I remember one of the first shows we did. I mean, I think, yeah, it was my man Beyond. It was a cat, Beyond. Extra Infinite, that was the name of his and Extra Infinite.
Extra, you know, Infinite.
Not cause, yeah, just, I mean, because it's not just enough to be infinite, you know, because we got to be extra infinite. but yeah, man, shout out to him. I haven't seen that brother in years, but he was one of the first cats to like to pay me out around here. And I want to say, yeah, he had a show, it was called Liquid Flows, and I want to say, like, God, he might have paid us, I mean, was it, I mean, he might have been like $75 or something.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was, you know what I mean? It was just, fuck it. I got gas money. I got, you know, I got lunch money for, you know, I can go eat, you know, at work tomorrow. You know what I'm saying? Just, you know, that was big money at the time. So I was happy to see that. That, you know, $25-$30, whatever it ended up being after we split it, you know what I'm saying? But yeah, I mean, we would just pretty much perform wherever we could and wherever they were willing to have us. And, you know, those early performances, I mean, they were rough, you know, in the sense that around here, like, you know, which I guess is the same, you know, anywhere else. If you don't have like a radio single or if you don't have a song that people know or whatever, I mean, it's going to be, you know, hard going, man. You know what I'm saying? And we performed to a lot of blank stares, you know, a lot of blank stares, a lot just like, okay, whatever, you know. And because this is at the time, I mean, you know, again, we were doing like kind of sample based hip hop. And this is, you know, 2001 or so, you know, so this is kind of 2001, 02, and this is kind of before, well, it's not before, because Blueprint came out in 01. Blueprint was 01.
Right.
So we were doing, you know, shows, this is like 01, 02. This is kind of before the Blueprint really hit and kind of brought back the sample sound in a big way. You know what I'm saying? It was kind of before the resurgence of that. So this is kind of still, for us, kind of the post, I want to say the post-Swizz Beatz kind of keyboard era, you know what I mean? Where if you wasn't rapping over that kind of stuff down here, people wasn't giving you, you know, they wasn't really checking for you, you know? So, yeah, we performed to a lot of blank stares, a lot of folded arms, but I wanted my $75, so fuck them. Shit, I got bills.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned samples, because on Intergalactic Soul, you talk about samples, right? And you position them as kind of a way to connect with the past, right? With a kind of like, almost like collective past of black music.
It's soon to be changed. We sample breaks from Montana to cool in the game. The presence of our ancestors due to remain in the music. So we bring it live back like the snares is rocking do-rags underneath fitted hi-hats. Never have we did it like that.
Can you talk about that a little more? Like, not just the actual sound of samples, but what it means to you to use them.
Oh, man, absolutely. You know, samples are very much, you know, Ninth, he has a thing that he says that, you know, samples are very much, you know, the modern day drum, in the sense that, you know, in the days of slavery, you know, the slaves used drums to pass messages to each other. You know what I'm saying? And now we do that with samples. You know, we do that, I feel, with, you know, sending messages in these records. You know, even Amir, Questlove, he talks about Donuts and how that being, you know, Dilla's final record, and just how listening to it, you just pick up on a lot of stuff. It's like, okay, who is he talking to in this one? You know, he's clearly sending these messages because, you know, he kind of knew this was going to be, you know, his swan song, you know? So yeah, I think, you know, samples are definitely a way of communicating. I think that they just are a way to just completely recontextualize something and put it in a way that's more palatable to an audience that may not have, you know, gotten the first thing. You know, it, asking my 13-year-old to sit down and listen to, you know, Mystic Brew by Ronnie Foster. That's, you know, that may be a long shot, but I can get him to listen to Electric Relaxation. And what that does, at least, you know, what it did for me, it just opened up a whole new world of music for me, you know, because you first start off listening to records, trying to listen for samples. But then after a while, you just start listening to it for music. And it's just like, yo, this shit is fucking jamming. You know what I'm saying? Like, this shit just, you know, aside from me sampling it, like, I just want to listen to it. This shit is going on. And you know, if it wasn't for hip hop, I never would have. It introduced me, even though I came up listening to a lot of music as a kid, it just really opened my ears to just, you know, so much, so many artists that I probably never would have given a shot otherwise.
Right.
And to me, that's the importance of it. And I think, you know, artists now are seeing the importance of it in terms of even with like clearing samples and letting the younger generation use it because they see that that's their bridge to the youth, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, and as well as their bridge to some pretty big fucking sampling
right.
publishing
some
royalties
checks,
as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, some checks, you know what I'm saying? You know what I mean? And I'm with it. I mean, shit, I love to see them, you know, get paid. So, yeah, that's kind of what sampling was for me.
You know, one of your songs I think that has really affected a lot of people is All For You.
Okay.
That tune from The Minstrel Show.
Uh-huh.
And it's about, you know, kind of reckoning about how you ended up in a similar situation to your own father.
But damn, our memories can be so misleading. It's misery, I hate to see history repeating. Thought you were the bad guy, but I guess that's why me and my girl split and my son is leaving.
So can you talk a little bit about kind of gaining empathy for your father as your own family kind of was falling apart and how you worked that into the song?
Oh, yeah, man. With that record, you know, you just I think everybody goes through that moment where, you know, when you're young, you see your parents as just, you know, their mom and dad, and they're, you know, they're just, oh, that's my mama, that's my daddy, you know what I'm saying? But as you get older, you just start to see them as people, and, you know, they kind of lose that veneer of, you know, of mom or dad, and just they lose that kind of superhero quality. And, you know, you kind of see him as, you know, as Clark Kent, you know, and you just kind of see him outside of the suit, you know what I'm saying? And you just realize that they're just human, just flawed people, you know? And for me, fatherhood definitely gave me insight, I think, into my own father, into, you know, understanding that things weren't all his fault, you know what I'm saying? As they seldom are, you know, whenever a relationship, you know, deteriorates, there's, you know, only in the most rare of cases, I mean, there's a little bit of blame to go around on both sides, you know. But with him, and once I became a father, that just gave me a completely new appreciation and an understanding of what he was dealing with. You know, I had my first son, I was 21. I was 21 myself, 21, 22? Don't get me lying. No, I was 21, I'm sure. I'm like, I'm thinking about this. I'm like, God damn, I was 21, about to be 22. But yeah, I was 21. And, you know, my dad had me, you know, he was 17. And, you know, it's not until you get in it and you look back. And, you know, when you're a kid, you know, looking at a 21-year-old, you know, they're adults to you. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're like, oh, that's my dad. That's my mom. They know what to do. Like, they got it all figured out. And then when you turn 21 and you realize just
you don't know
how
shit, yeah.
Yeah, you're like, oh, my God. Like, they were fucking idiots because I'm a fucking idiot. You know what I mean? Like, there was no way in hell, like, how did they figure this shit out? And so it just gives you a much greater appreciation, you know, once you get to that point in your life where they were. And, you know, now I'm at this point and I have a kid to take care of as well. It's really, you know, it's heavy stuff, man. But it definitely gives you a greater appreciation for your parents as people and makes you, at least in my case, it certainly makes you a lot more empathetic and just, you know, a lot more caring in a lot of ways. It softened my heart in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And, you know, when we had Pooh on, I asked him about Separate But Equal, and I wanted to ask you about that record as well, because I feel like it's coming from such a different place than a lot of the other Little Brother records. It's like, I don't know, a lot angrier in some ways, a lot more aggressive. Mm-hmm. Like, obviously, Pooh has that long monologue towards the beginning where he's screaming at people.
So you just gonna fade the beat out on me, man? Some of these motherfucking rappers need to fade the beat out on their motherfucking careers, man. You know what I'm saying? Because them niggas suck, man. And then they want to cipher with me after the motherfucking shows and shit, man. A nigga tired, man. My motherfucking voice hurt, man. You know what I'm saying?
Beyond even that, you know, it's... it's kind of coming from a very different place, I think, than a lot of your other records. Can you talk about where to your head was at when you did Separate But Equal?
Yeah, man. Separate But Equal was just, that was just, you know, our reaction to the Minstrel Show not doing, you know, not doing what we thought it was going to do. And I always say not really not doing what we thought it was going to do, but just also, you know, the label reaction to it. You know what I'm saying? That was us really having to prove that we belong, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, we did the Minstrel Show, and the Minstrel Show was, you know, we got a lot of backlash, a lot of flack. Oh, they just whatever, they just, you know, they just backpackers, they just this, they just that, or whatever. So then when it came time for Separate Equal, we was like, look, we got to show these motherfuckers that, you know, yeah, we went to college, yeah, we not talking about, you know, selling dope and none of that shit, but pound for pound, it's like, just put me on the mic. I'll rap you motherfuckers.
With no time to sit back and recline, because it seemed like each time we critically acclaimed but commercially declined. And now I'm inclined like a bench press to speak my mind and my interests about this music. Everybody keep...
You know what I'm saying? Over on a drama tape, you want to... Drama want to put the gunshots all over the shit? Just... You know what I mean? Just all the hood, like put all that hood shit over it.
H-O-J. If this would it take for y'all niggas to pay attention, then so be it. Little brother said they want the street, so I'ma hand the streets over.
You know what I mean? At the end of the day, you know, we're MCs, and we gonna show you that we MCs, and we can roll however you want to roll. Niggas want to do, you know, trap shit, mixtape shit. You want to do, you know, kind of highbrow, kind of art concept shit. We can go, we can walk in any lane. And so that was Separate But Equal, yeah, for me. It was just really wanting to just validate ourselves, I think, and just really just show people that even though the record didn't do what we thought it would do, you know, we're not just going to just lay down and fucking die.
Yeah. And on that record, you have Boondock Saints. That song lays out a particular quandary for you, where you kind of lay out feeling like you're too intelligent for, you know, some of your black fans and too street for your white fans, and kind of feeling caught in between.
Black folks saying that I'm too intelligent, and white folks saying I'm a little too niggerish. It got me in a strange predicament. I wish black embarrassment TV would judge more wisely, but I don't know what's worse, the fact that they ain't playing our shit, or the fact that it don't even surprise me, because I ain't shucking, and because I ain't jiving. Some of these crackers won't stand beside me, and because I ain't killing and don't support pimping, some of these niggas want to call me Cosby. Well,
was there any kind of like particular incident or thing people said that kind of inspired you to write that, or was it just kind of overall responses you were getting? Like, what's the context behind that song and like that idea?
Yeah, I mean, it was just, yeah, I think I was just kind of having this I had this conversation with a friend of mine the other day, you know. You know, I think the thing with Little Brother was that we were, while, you know, I personally, you know, I'm not going to go as far as to say that we were doing anything that was revolutionary or that was just so, you know, kind of avant-garde. I mean, in my opinion, I don't think we were doing that. But what I do think is that we were ahead of our time. We were, well, we're not ahead of our time. We were just before our time. So, you know, at the time when we came out, I mean, this is, you know, 05, 06, you know, when we came with Minstrel Show, and, you know, look at what the hot records were on the radio at that time. You know, it was, you know, the stuff I mentioned earlier, it was, you know, the it was the ringtone stuff.
Anything you could snap to.
Yeah. If you could snap to it, bruh, we was snapping like hell. You know what I mean? And, not to be confused with Turbo B of Snap.
Or I will attack and you don't want that.
But not to be confused, this was the original Snapper.
Right.
But nah, dude, you know, it was just, we were like sore thumbs. We were completely sore thumbs. And versus now, where you look at, you know, cats like Kendrick, you know, cats like Cole, you know, cats, you know, even like a Wale, you know what I'm saying? Where, you know, you have these guys who have this lane, and they're able to exist because they, you know, I think they're able to exist all because of each other. They all kind of need each other to continue to survive, you know? And, you know, and that was something that I tried to do as much as I could while we were on Atlantic, in the sense that, you know, I spoke with whoever their kind of left of center artists were at the time. And, you know, at the time, all we had was, it was Lupe. Lupe was signed, and Saigon. And, you know, I remember just reaching out to them and just being like, look, dude, if we want to survive, you know, we got to do records together. We have to do something just to form some kind of bond or something, just to show people, you know, this is A and this is B. You know what I'm saying? Not beefing with nobody, not nothing like that, but just, you know, we got to have strength in numbers, you know? And, you know, man, so yeah, it was, so that time writing that verse, honestly, I mean, I didn't even really want to do that verse. I didn't even want to do that song. I think it was one of those songs like I had agreed to do like way, way beforehand. And then when it came time to do it, I literally was fresh off a tour. And I was like, fuck, man, I got to do this shit for real. I was like, fuck, you know, I gave my word. I was like, fuck, I'll do this shit. But yeah, I really did not. I didn't want to do that record.
And that,
was,
and that's why that came out so raw.
Yeah. I was pissed the fuck off about a whole lot of shit. And so, that was just kind of what I was experiencing at that time. And, you know, we want a label, and I just don't really think they got us, you know. I mean, looking back over, you know, I don't really blame Atlantic. You know, I don't think that, you know, I mean, I think they at the end of the day, I mean, they let us say what we wanted to say, and they gave us an outlet and a platform to put it out to as many people, you know, as we could. So, you know, man, I don't hold no ill will or nothing towards them. I just think that, again, at the time we came out, there was nothing like us, you know what I'm saying? And it was just a tricky sell. So, yeah, I was kind of caught in that middle ground. It was just, you know, some of the black fans thought we were too, you know, thought it was just too kind of highbrow or whatever. And then, you know, the white execs and some of the white fans, you know, they were just like, what the fuck? Like, this is too... Like, what do we do with these guys? You know what I mean? They couldn't put us in a box. They couldn't figure out what to do with it.
Yeah. And I did want to ask about Foreign Exchange a little bit. You know, the first Foreign Exchange, you're rapping a lot. But the second one, Leave It All Behind, is really the first album where you're singing lead vocals basically all the way through a record.
You just keep on trying to push me away. So far to go.
Was that a scary thing to do?
Doing it on record wasn't scary. Doing it like live was scary. You know what I'm saying? And you know, that was just something to where, I mean, me and Nick, you know, with Foreign Exchange, it was always something that was, you know, kind of like a side project. You know what I'm saying? It was very much just me and Nick just kind of doing our own thing, just kind of, it always kind of played second fiddle to Little Brother. And, you know, at the time when we did Connected, our first album, you know, Nick was working at like a fucking computer help desk or some shit. Like, he was like a customer service guy, you know what I mean? And like, I was, you know, Little Brother hadn't really popped off like that. I was still just kind of doing stuff here and there. I was kind of working my job, coming home, you know, doing stuff. So it hadn't really jumped all the way off yet. But the Foreign Exchange was just kind of something that was a side project. So when it came time for us to do our second album, I mean, we didn't expect to get the response that we got. You know what I mean? With me singing the songs, I mean, prior to that, I had just been writing songs and doing reference tracks for singers, just really wanting to be a songwriter. I wanted to write songs. I didn't really ever really want to sing songs. I just wanted to write.
Right. You talked about that once, about how you wanted to be you called it the name in the parentheses.
I want to be the name in the parentheses, bro. That's where the checks is at. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't need to be famous. I don't need people to know my name. Like, just know my music. and nowhere to send my publishing check. You know what I mean? So yeah, so that was always kind of my thing. And so when it came time for us to do the second Foreign Exchange, I worked on Leave It All Behind. I hadn't really had any success as a songwriter, so I was just like, well, you know what? I'm just going to sing my own songs and just, I mean, fuck it. Let's just, you know, see what happens. And the shit, it really kind of took off. And so even then, once it took off, I was just kind of like, okay, well, cool. And then I remember us getting calls for shows. And that,
and you're like,
just,
oh, man.
Right. It's like, fuck. It's like, it's real now. You know what I mean? Like, now I really got to do it. Like, I really, it's like, shit, y'all really like this? Now I got to go sing it. Oh, shit. And I was never nervous about singing. I mean, because, you know, again, I mean, I grew up singing in church and I sang in public before. So it wasn't the singing aspect that was kind of nerve-wracking for me. For me, it was more so just trying to figure out, okay, how do you pivot from going from touring as a rapper to now you're touring as a singer? And it didn't really, that, I don't think I really, I honestly, I just probably got a hold on that probably as recently as like maybe 2 years ago.
Wow.
You know,
so the idea is you don't want fans to think, okay, I'll wait till he sings a few songs so I can wait to hear him rap.
Right, right. Yeah, you don't want to do it just as like, you know, people thinking of it as just your singing is just a placeholder until you just kill the mic with 72 bars, nigga. It's like, nah, that ain't what the fuck we doing. So but it took some time. It took some time for me to find my voice. It took some time for me to find my presence, you know, as a singer, you know, and what that looks like. It's taken me some time to just grow into that, you know. I mean, rapping, I mean, I've been rapping for, you know, God knows how long. I mean, rap is something, you know, I've been, you know, doing for a while. But, you know, singing was something that, I mean, that took a while for me to find that, to find myself in that. You know what I mean? Because, again, it wasn't, I didn't intend the shit to go this far. You know what I mean? I really, and I've said this before in like other interviews, you know, ideally, you know, Leave It All Behind or just all that stuff. I mean, those would have been records that I wrote for other people and other people would have sang and they would have, you know, toured them and did whatever.
Yeah.
I just didn't think people would respond to it in that way.
Yeah. And, you know, you had one solo album, another one down the line. We'll talk about that in just a second, another one a few months away. But Charity Starts at Home, you know, you have that song Eternally on it, the duet mm-hmm. with You and Me. And you guys talk about your shared past and all that kind of stuff.
But there's something in them that says go and get them, center them, show them you the sender.
This is 308 style, ninth wonder with the owl. Peace to Kapalu, Deji, Leroy McDowell, Blau, North Hall was the centerpiece. Young Bucks, baby killer bees. Before the days of a Twitter feed, we keep the beats banging. Still swinging like Reebie Jackson singing by the centipede. One room.
I heard somewhere that he was maybe originally supposed to have been in Little Brother. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah, he wasn't gonna be in Little Brother. Median was gonna originally supposed to be on Speed, which was the first Little Brother song. The song was originally supposed to be Speed was supposed to be me and Median over a knife track. You know what I'm saying? And Median was always the guy, he would just get ghost and shit. He would just like fucking vanish and like he'd show up and, you know, you wouldn't see him again for like 3 months and shit. So we would just have running jokes like, oh, there was a Median sighting today. Like he was like a fucking UFO or some shit. You know what I mean? So yeah, he would just kind of randomly pop up. But yeah, man, Speed was originally supposed to be me and Median over a knife track. And at the time, I want to say he didn't show up to the studio. He was late or he was something. I can't remember what the fuck he did. But he was being Median. It was a very Median thing that he was, you know, he was Medianing. And so so he didn't make it. And so Pooh came. Or did I pick up Pooh? I can't remember. It's been so many years, I can't remember. But anyway, me and Pooh ended up doing the record.
Yeah, got a nigga about to go and burn the road again. From first gear to fifth gear, out of control again.
And that's the way we rolling in. Needed to chill and take a rest stop. Cause my job got me slaving like I'm Dred Scott. Take a break.
And so we sat down and we listened to it and we finished it and we was just all sitting there together like, holy shit, like we got something. You know, and so that was, you know, how Little Brother started. But yeah, originally Medium was supposed to be on Speed. So, you know, had it been him, I mean, I don't know how it would have
turned out the same. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely would turn out the same. And Medium, that's my man. I mean, we have, you know, good chemistry, you know, together. We always have enjoyed working with each other. But, you know, with Little Brother, I think that was something that was very special. And it, I don't think it could have worked any other way without the three people who were involved.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. You and Median definitely have great chemistry on that track, though. That album, the Charity Starts at Home album, you've made no bones about how it was recorded in the midst of a divorce, which is something that comes through.
Something in the way society rears us, commitment wears us out, it tears us apart and make us feel like we don't need to. And that turns into I don't need you. People want what grandma and granddaddy had, but they ain't have options, nigga, we do.
And we choose. Can you talk about your state of mind writing and recording that and how you kind of balanced, like, the singing tracks and more traditional, more straight ahead kind of rap stuff while, you know, all this was going on?
Yeah, I mean, I just really wanted to just my goal with Cherry's Thoughts at Home was just that, you know, I needed a kind of a Fonte primer album, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, a lot of people, I mean, I got a lot of, you know, love for the record. And, you know, I also received, you know, some criticism like, ah, man, I wish it was, why we got singing? So I just want to hear bars. I just want to hear that. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, and the thing about it was this, that for me, I was in a position and still am in a lot of ways where a lot of people know my music. They may know who I am, but when it comes to, you know, explaining who I am and what I do, there's a lot you got to do. It's like, oh, well, Fonte is my favorite rapper. Okay, well, what does he do? Oh, well, okay, first he was in this group called Little Brother, and you can find their stuff. And then he's got this other group called Foreign Exchange. And then he got this Zone Tickle of Love, the 80s. And then, you know what I mean? Like, I've been a part of a lot of shit that has not necessarily been under my own name. I've kind of had my hands in a lot of different musical pots. So with Charity Starts at Home, I wanted to make the record that if you are trying to turn somebody on to Fonte, have them start there. Because right there, you can get everything. You got the rhyming, you got some singing, the soul. You know, you just tell them to start there. And then depending on what they like from that record, if they want more of the hip-hop stuff, okay, they can check Little Brother. If they like, you know, the R&B stuff, then they can check Foreign Exchange. But, you know, you had to give people just a starting point. So that was my concept. That was my idea with Cherry Starts at Home. It just happened to be that I wrote the shit. And like I said, you know, while I was going through a divorce. So a lot of that came out on the page. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, you know, I just, as always, I mean, my goal is just to create a snapshot of where I was at that point when I recorded it. And yeah, man, it was some heavy shit, you know. It's not a record I can't say it's a record I don't revisit very often. I mean, I don't really revisit a lot of my records once they're done. But yeah, it's a very cynical album, you know. And I mean, when I first put it out, a lot of response I got, you know, when I sent it, like, early copies to my friends and stuff, they were just like, man, I just didn't expect it to be this angry. Like, I didn't expect it to, wow. And then that's when I realized, I'm like, oh, like, y'all were expecting the listening minus Pooh and Ninth, you know what I mean? And it's just like, well, nah, dude, I'm just not that happy-go-lucky guy anymore. I'm happy, but, you know, just the kind of innocence of those early records, I mean, you can never regain that once it's gone.
Yeah.
So, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So that's just kind of where I was in writing that.
Yeah. So speaking of early records, there's one final project that I have to ask you about before I let you go, which is The Story of Us. Amazing, amazing. For people who don't know, why don't you describe it real quick before I ask you stuff about it? What is The Story of Us?
Man, the Story of Us is a joke album. It's like a parody freestyle album that I did back in 2000 in my homie Eccentric in his room at his crib. Eccentric, he's the cat who he did the get up from The Listening.
This is for fucking Gerald right here. Yo, y'all can't do it like Tay do it. I can't stop, won't stop like a Ford Explorer without the brake fluid. Spinning out on five stones with the shake to it, leaving all the passengers with scraped bruises. My rap style, niggas.
And he's now a lawyer now. He stopped making beats. He had a hard drive crash like back in 2001, 2002, something like that. And this shit just like, he lost like hundreds of beats. And I guess he just took it as a sign from God. It's like, fuck it, I'm going to law school. So so we lost a great beat maker in that hard drive crash. But, you know, he's off to big and better things. And but yeah, Story of Us was just it was a record that I had did at his crib, you know, just this is back in, again, this is like 2000, you know what I'm saying, where he just had like some beats over there, just random kind of instrumentals. And it was basically me just imitating other rappers and telling a story about two underground rappers. The group was called U.S., which stood for Unheralded Symmetrics.
You know what I'm saying? They got to feel this shit. Yo, this is us, yo. I'm saying, I'm that illest nigga. Paradox, the bilateral metaphor. Yo, yo, talking to talk diplomacy. Protocol, understand through my biangle, triangle, diametric.
So I was like, just trying to come up with the most underground backpack fucking name ever. But they were like these two kind of underground rappers who were going around trying to shop their demo to different labels. And every label they went to, the label wanted them to sound like another rapper. So it was basically me imitating other rappers.
Yo, I'm KMX, fucking with them. Yo, y'all niggas don't know. Rough Riders, dry little niggas. And you know I got pride. I got pride with my niggas. Oh, they thought I was on some crazy shit. Said I was on crack, baby, suck dick. Went to the jailhouse, snapped it out. Oh, motherfuckers know what I'm talking about.
Now all them niggas up on the left of me, you're sipping that E&J. I got to make my money, player, this is what I say. I'm rolling through ATL with my niggas in the back, dropping them real dollar bills and rolling out in Cadillac. Yes, sir.
And then at the end, they strike gold and they do a country song with Aaron Neville and Eminem and Dr. Dre.
I'm saying I'm feeling on your ass with Aaron Neville. She didn't want to come down to my lower level because she was in the basement, steady locked away. And so I get a phone call, called Dr. Dre.
Yo, Slim, what I'm saying, you can't fuck with you. You know that bitch is crazy, she can't duck from you.
Yeah, I'm saying, Dre, but if she wasn't...
And that kind of, you know... I know that for people who haven't heard it, I mean, it's... It's. I know this sounds fucking insane.
It's.
But,
I mean, it's right, so. But. It's so funny, and so you imitate just, you know, tons of people throughout the album. DMX, the entire Wu-Tang Clan, Eminem and Dr. Dre, like Aaron Neville, like you said. It's you know, unbelievably funny. Like, first of all, how did you manage to do all those voices?
Man, dog, I just went for broke, man. You know, I just did it, you know, as best I could. And, you know, it was just mimicking, just, you know, all the cats that I imitated, I mean, they were cats that I listened to, you know. I couldn't imitate, you know, motherfuckers that I don't really dig, you know what I'm saying? So I was hoping that if anyone heard, I mean, they kind of took it as a, you know, just as a feather in the hat, you know, just kind of a, just a, you know, just kind of a hat tip of like, well, if he can imitate me, that means he's been listening to me.
Yeah. Did you ever hear from anyone you imitated on that record?
I never heard from anyone. But one thing I did, one moment of, you know, the validation that I did receive, my buddy, Brainchild, who I used to do Gordon Gartrell radio with, Brainchild was actually working at Universal Records at the time. He was like an intern. He was doing something at Universal. I don't know if he was an intern or he was doing whatever. He was working there. And so he was playing the Wayne kind of Hot Boys parody track in the office.
I be like, Stevie, you can't see me. It's the BB. And I'm the Juve. Nigga couldn't understand. Loose said, come through. I'm a pearl like Loose said. Niggas like Tropicana want a juice man. You can't produce man. Only Manny Fresh.
And he told me that like their A&R guy or like their tour guy, like one of the guys that was actually working their record was listening to the parody record and was like, yo, that shit is dope. Like, when did they send you that one? And I was like, oh my God. He's like, they didn't know that it was just a complete, you know, a fucking parody. So that was cool. I mean, that was, you know, those are moments that, again, I mean, you can't pay for that.
Yeah.
It's just gold. So the record is on, I think it's out for free now. You can just find it online. You can just download it or whatever. You can get it for free. And it was just a record I did in like, it was like 2-3 days just freestyling at my man's crib and just kind of bugging out.
Yeah, so. I didn't know it existed until Dan Tarnas mentioned it in the context of why he thought of you for the breaks. I guess, you know, he figured someone who could do that could write a handful of rappers in 1990 with no problem.
Yeah, man. And again, man, I just do like something like that just to see the way that kind of came full circle, you know. And I stress this to artists all the time is just to, you know, use every tool that's in your toolbox because you never know which one is going to knock the wall down. You know what I'm saying? You may think it's the hammer. You may think it's the sledgehammer, but, you know, it may be the chisel. You know what I'm saying? It may just be, you know, that tool that you never thought would materialize into something. That's what kind of is your breakthrough. And so, you know, for me, you know, just I never would have guessed that me literally just freestyling in my homeboy's room for 3 days and just kind of fucking around would lead to me, you know, having my first role on television. Yeah. No one thinks that far ahead.
Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. Right. How would you imagine? So there's going to be this TV show in, you know,
right,
15
right.
years.
15 years, right. It's like, what the fuck, man? What kind of, you know, what kind of alternate universe shit is that?
Right.
So yeah, I mean, I'm just really thankful and blessed. But I tell young artists all the time, like, look, use every tool in your toolbox. Use, you know, if you can sing, rap. Don't let anybody box you in because you never know which one is going to hit. And 9 times out of 10, the thing that's going to – that hits is not the thing that you thought was going to hit. You know what I'm saying? I'm sure, you know, The Rock, who is a big inspiration of mine, you know, I'm sure he – didn't see himself doing movies and becoming a movie star and a TV producer. You know what I'm saying? Just the way he's been able to transition. You know what I'm saying? So I look at cats like that. I mean, even cats like Steve Harvey, who's gone from just a stand-up comedian to, you know, the talk show host and host of Family Feud and having his books. You know what I'm saying? You know, I admire that hustle. And, you know, so to young guys coming up and young, you know, guys and girls, you know, men and women alike, you know, I just always stress to them, like, look, man, use every tool in your box. If you can sing. If you can rap, dance, act, draw, cook, motherfucker. You see, you know, Action Bronson got a cooking show. Like, motherfucker, use every tool in your toolbox. Do not leave anything to chance because you never know which one is going to hit.
Yeah. And finally, you know, you announced a little while ago that this is going to be a busy, maybe 6 months for you in terms of projects. You have 2 or 3 things coming out. Anything you can tell us?
The first one coming out is my man Zoe, who is the keyboardist and musical director for the Foreign Exchange for our band, our touring band. And his record Skybreak is coming out on May 20th. And, you know, I'm really excited about that. We're actually in the process of wrapping that up this week. And, you know, just an incredible record. I can't wait for everybody to hear it. As with, you know, all his records, I'm kind of I'm co-producing and co-writing, you know, along, you know, with him. And that'll be out May 20th, Skybreak from Zoe. July 22nd, we got the album from myself and Eric Robinson. And we haven't decided on the title yet, but that's July 22nd. That's coming out. Arrow, who's one of my biggest inspirations and pretty much wrote the book on independent soul, you know what I'm saying? You know, he's just a pioneer in a lot of those aspects. And, you know, just friend of mine, you know, brother of mine, and that's coming. Our record is coming July 22nd. And then finally at the end of the year, we got September 30th is my second solo album, No News Is Good News. And, yeah, That's it.
Anything?
And then somehow in between, yeah. I got a tour and right. like be a dad and shit. So right. I'll figure out how the fuck I'm going to do all that shit.
anything you can tell us about No News is Good News?
September 30th.
Okay. All right.
All your questions will be answered.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you. It's great talking to Psychological from Eternal Atoms, one of my favorite artists.
Listen, man. Who told you that one, dude? Where'd you get that? Oh, did I say that?
Slip once.
Oh, fuck. Oh, my God. That's like, oh, man. That's some dark web shit right there, brother. Yeah, that was my first rap name, Psychological. It was, and it was spelled in all caps with a question mark at the end. It was just so much teenage angst.
that's amazing. Thank you so much.
Oh, man, thanks for having me, man. This has been a lot of fun.
Towards the end of the interview, where Fonte has that section talking about using every tool in his toolbox, that really has an incredible resonance when you think about his career. There's really not much that he can't do musically, like rapping, singing, writing battle rap set in 1990, imitating the entire Dungeon family. This made him really fun to talk to. I was also super excited to get a rhyming clinic from him, and I hope you aspiring MCs out there were frantically scribbling notes. Also, getting to discuss sampling, singing, and even doing impressions made this one of the most fascinating episodes that I think we've ever had. Join us next week when our guest will be Anton Pukchansky. You may not know Anton's name, but you definitely know his work. If you've ever listened to artists like Large Professor, Kool G Rap, Eric B. and Rakim, or Nas, you've heard his handiwork as a musician, engineer, and mixer. Make sure to listen to the episode in order to get the inside scoop on how classic songs like Let the Rhythm Hit 'Em, Live at the Barbecue, Streets of New York, and countless more were really made. As I mentioned at the top, make sure you subscribe to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, give us a rating or a review. If you want to take an extra step to support the show, you can make a donation at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Even $1 a month will go a long way. You can find us everywhere on social media at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. More information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
He was who sampled before who sampled.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
You know, he could be the ladies man. He could battle rap.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Put all that hood shit over it.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
He was kind of MF Doom before MF Doom.
Our intern is Aziza Hassan.
I didn't intend the shit to go this far.
Special thanks to our newest Patreon supporter, Kaya Babzani.
I wanted my $75, so fuck him.
And super extra special thanks to episode 35, 52, and 85 guest Adam Mansbach for making this interview happen.
It just became harder to parody something that often parodied itself.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Yeah, man. Fuck them motherfuckers, man. Goddamn.